This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to our weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Rufaro Manyepa.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Daniel DeSanto.
Hello.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
Well, here in America, we celebrated Thanksgiving Day yesterday, a wonderful day, a day to be thankful for all the blessings that God gives us, to be thankful to live in probably the most blessed nation ever in history, to remember America's blessed history and the role that God played in it. Well, for our first story today, we will look at something showing the state of today's world, where in America's public schools, students are getting a very different message out of Thanksgiving. For this, we will turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, you have to feel bad for the poor kids in Portland, Oregon. In a lot of ways, that school district is kind of like the vanguard for radical leftist indoctrination in education. Normally, you'd think that during the month of November, when Thanksgiving coming up, that a school district would focus on the actual history of Thanksgiving, the history of the pilgrims and how God helped them through their first winters here, about their alliance with the Wampanoag tribe and how the Native Americans actually shared in that first Thanksgiving meal. But in Portland, with their they declared November Native American Heritage Month. And they've gone through how Thanksgiving is actually an American celebration of the genocide of Native American tribes. They assigned a book called A Young People's History of the United States by the Marxist historian Howard Zinn that's supposed to be kind of like a dumbed-down version of his more famous book, A People's History of the United States. And if you know anything about that book, A People's History of the United States, producing a dumbed-down version of it is quite an accomplishment. But it really paints a very stereotypical picture of all Native American tribes, not looking at the differences between one tribe or another, but having them all of like this peace-loving, nature-worshipping, childlike culture. That's something more from like a Disney Pocahontas movie than real life. Mm-hmm. As I hinted at earlier, they don't mention anything at all about the Pilgrims' alliance with the Wampanoag tribe, the fact that they helped each other, they shared this meal together. There were peaceful relationships between these two cultures for 55 years. By the time Chief Massasoit died, his entire tribe had converted to Christianity, accepted European customs, and it wasn't until like the chiefdom of one of his younger sons, who was becoming afraid that their people were losing their culture, that you had King Philip's War start. And even that, those battles started as a surprise attack on the part of the Indians on the colonists because they were afraid that too many of their people were assimilating into American society. You'll get none of that nuance in the Portland school system. Instead, they're going on exactly what the Spanish conquistadors did to the Aztec Empire and the Incan Empire. They're saying that the English colonists did to the tribes they encountered. Mm-hmm. I think there's even one section in the book where there's a quote from this book that said, "The English used a form of warfare that Cortez had used in Mexico. To fill the enemy with terror, they attacked civilians, people who are not warriors. They set fires to wigwams. And as the Indians ran out to escape the flames, the English cut them into bits with their swords." Like I said, even in Cortez's case, when you actually look into the demonism and human sacrifice in the Aztec Empire, there's a lot more nuance to what he did than this book's proclaiming. But in the case of the English settlers in Massachusetts and Virginia, this is just... Those are just complete lies through and through.
Yeah. Well, we do have a knack for getting our young people to hate the country that they're a part of. And you can see with this kind of education why you have more and more young people who are basically believing that this is the most violent, racist, oppressive country in world history. And there's obviously a whole story that would provide context to everything that took place there. It just makes me think about the United States and Britain in prophecy and the understanding that that book gives us about how God was behind the whole exodus of individuals from Europe, came to this country, and God turned this into the most blessed country in the history of the world in many ways because of that birthright promise that he had made to Abraham. It would be a wonderful counter to this warped view of history that they're getting for these kids if they were able to read the United States and Britain in prophecy and put it in context, even if they just read an unbiased view of American history. It would make a huge difference. I feel like the more you learn about America's history, the more you realize just what an exceptional nation, what an exceptional history it has. So, well, we appreciate you bringing that to us very much. We'll put a link to the United States and Britain in Prophecy in the show notes. Anything else that you would refer people to for more information about that?
Our editor-in-chief's book, Great Again, goes a little bit more into current events and those how those are filling Bible prophecy. But he has a statement in there that America is one of the birthright nations of Israel. God has blessed this land abundantly. Perhaps America's greatest sin is ingratitude to God for making America great. And that's something you see even amongst conservatives in society can be very guilty of just a sense of apathy or for not appreciating what God's done to this country. But then you look at like what they're doing in the Portland school district, and that goes beyond just apathy or ingratitude towards just like an active sense of hostility toward God for making America great.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. We'll move over to Asia right now. Hong Kong, as we've been talking about, has been experiencing mass-scale public protests for some months against interference by China. Well, this week, the people of Hong Kong held an election, and the result is not going to please the Chinese. For this story, we'll go to Rufaro Manyepa.
Yes, sir. This last Sunday, Hong Kong held its local district council elections, and it was a sweeping landslide victory by the pro-democracy candidates. They won 389 of 452 seats that were up for grabs, and the Beijing-backed government won only 58 of those seats, down from 300 seats that they held before. And these elections come after months of protests in Hong Kong that were triggered by the February incident of the extradition bill that was proposed by the Hong Kong government to mainland China. And the people have been protesting about this. They've been really, really angry about it. And the protests haven't stopped. And so these elections were widely viewed as a referendum on the views of the Hong Kong people on increased China interference within local politics. And with this result, it was met with so much celebration and happiness by the Hong Kong people, because they believe that finally they're getting to show how they really feel. China had been talking about how there was a quote-unquote silent majority that really did not mind what was happening, and that the protests were only overshadowing what was actually held by the majority of the people. But these results paint a really different story. There was a turnout of nearly 3 million voters to the booths, which is I think about 70% of the eligible electorate in Hong Kong, far more than has gone to vote in recent months. And it really does show what the people of Hong Kong think about China's increased influence in Hong Kong. But what's really worrying is how China has responded to these election results. The foreign minister of China, Mr. Wang Yi, came out and said that whatever the results of the election are, China doesn't care. He said that Hong Kong belongs to China no matter what happens. And that was on Monday after these election results came out, which just says everything you need to know about China's stance towards these results, the results of these elections that happened. They really don't care what the people think because they have their own reasons for wanting Hong Kong, and nothing about what the people say or whatever foreign interference or push that happens with any foreign powers is really going to change that.
Yeah, this situation has been so illuminating about China's role in that area and the kind of authoritarianism that it's espousing. We've been talking about these concentration camps with the Uyghur Muslims and the ethnic minorities within China proper, and you get a very strong picture of the nature of the regime there, but the way that it's been handling this with Hong Kong. I mean, these protesters really have been very resilient in the face of pretty strong and increasingly strong crackdowns. But yeah, when they voice their opinion with such resounding unanimity in a lot of ways that China would just push that aside. It shows just how determined China is to force its will on this area. Maybe you can just give us a little bit of the prophetic context about Hong Kong's role relative to China, why this is significant.
Well, Hong Kong is a vital sea gate to the South China Sea. The South China Sea sees about $5.3 trillion worth of trade pass through it each year. And the South China Sea used to be controlled by the United States, and Hong Kong itself used to be a colony of Britain. So the United States and Britain had quite a measure of control over these two areas. But the United States Navy left the South China Sea, and China has been moving in to control those waters recently. And in 1997, Britain handed Hong Kong back to China, despite protests from the Hong Kong people themselves about this move. And what is happening is China is determined to control the South China Sea, is determined to control all that maritime trade. And Hong Kong gives China access to that. And Bible prophecy does indicate that Britain and the United States are going to lose sea gates and lose out on world trade. And that's what is happening here. You see with the decline of Britain and the United States seeing a corresponding rise in China and its powers in Asia Pacific. And it was prophesied in the Bible, Luke 21:24, Jesus Christ talks about the times of the Gentiles. And Gentiles are simply the non-Israelite people, non-American or British people in the world, and that is what is happening here with the control that China is getting over the South China Sea. I mean, you look at the fact that the United States passed a bill condemning what is happening in China and saying that they're going to annually look into what is happening in China, but China came out and responded and said that we don't appreciate what the United States is doing and saying, and if it doesn't repeal this bill, then we are going to take countermeasures of our own. I mean, this is the United States coming out and saying that this is wrong, but China is now saying, no, we think you're wrong. That's a dramatic shift over what has happened in the past. Mm. You know, in the past, if the United States says that this is wrong and it has to stop, then you basically knew that the issue was done and dusted. But here's China saying, no, we are fully justified in what we're doing. And if you don't take back what you're doing, then we're going to come after you. And that just shows the times that we're leading into. All this is pointing towards those times of the Gentiles.
Where would you send people for more information?
We have an article coming up on The Trumpet very soon on this topic itself. And we also have another article already up there titled Hong Kong, The End of Freedom Begins.
Well, thank you very much for that, Rufaro. Speaking of protests, we've been following mass protests in Iraq and Lebanon that are taking on an increasingly anti-Iran character. Well, there are quite significant protests with an anti-Iran character also taking place in Iran. For this story, we'll go to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
These are protests that began about a week ago, and you might not have heard, but they're the largest protests that Iran has experienced going back for about 40 years. They might have been the same size as, similar size to what happened in 2009, known as the Green Revolution, but this one has seen hundreds of thousands of Iranians out on the streets. There's been about 180 deaths, something like that, that we know of. Thousands of people, 7,000, have been injured as well. And this was largely in response to a price hike in the fuel price that the government said that they're going to increase by 50% for certain fuels. And it was kind of what tipped the people over the edge to come out and protest. Protests like they are seeing next door in Iraq, like they're seeing in Lebanon as well, which have all taken a very anti-Iranian regime flavor. And this is taking place, or well, it was taking place until, let's say, the beginning of about 2 or 3 days ago. The Iranian regime went after these protests to an amazing degree. They did not let them succeed. They forcefully put these down. They allowed for their the Basij and also the IRGC to go out and stop these protests. These are internal. Well, these are bodies that Iran has created since the Islamic Revolution to make sure that the Iranian regime doesn't fall by interior protests. So basically, they exist and they mobilize to try and stop protests from being successful, bringing the regime down. And there was an internet blackout of Iran for 5 days, and that's why not much information got out. Iran successfully stopped almost all of the internet in its entire country for 5 days, which really did hamper these protests from being able to spread. That's what they don't want, is the internet to be able to show people where, how large the protests are going to be, where to meet, that type of thing, because it just encourages them. So Iran showed an extraordinary ability to shut down the internet and internal communications in that country that stopped these as much as they're possible. It also stopped footage getting out of what was taking place, the brutal crackdown, the deliberate killing of people, the extortion also that Iran their extortion tactics against people, protesters that were killed, against the families of those killed. They basically said, if you want your son's body back because he was a protester, you're going to have to pay the state a lot of money as well. And so all these pretty brutal tactics to try and put down this rebellion. And most people, I would say, across the world, especially in the West, didn't even hear about them. And it looks like it's almost business as usual back in Iran this Friday.
Well, that's amazing. I definitely want to just ask you more about this crackdown in light of what we've been talking about in those other countries. But briefly circle back, the cause for this, the increase in petrol prices in Iran, some indication that, say, the financial pressure that the United States has been putting on Iran is having effect, that Iran is looking to raise money from somewhere and they're actually extracting it from their own people.
Yeah, they don't have too many choices in this and where they're going to get the money from. I mean, they've still got their smuggling routes and everything else, but Iran needs money, and so they need to clamp down on their own people. And ask more from their own people. And obviously the people are upset by this. I mean, the slogan, when the internet came back up, then you had the footage from people's devices that was shared all across the world. And people were protesting against the Iranian regime saying, you know, spend our money here. We are not Hezbollah. Stop sending money elsewhere across the, you know, worry about us, not everybody else. Because that's what they see. When the internet's up, they see that you've got Hezbollah saying they get all their money from Iran. Meanwhile, the Iranians are there struggling and they've got more taxes on the people. And so they're understandably upset. And it does indicate that the sanctions were being very successful. It is interesting when you think about why we didn't hear too much about this protest. One, the internet was down, but also the Western media outlets don't want to give President Trump or don't want to say that his maximum pressure campaign in Iran is working. That's the point of the pressure campaign, to pressure Iran's regime to come back to the negotiating table or something, or to provoke an internal rebellion against the regime. That's what they want. And yet Melanie Phillips pointed this out beautifully today. This week she wrote a column about this, that Iran has these most massive protests, but you didn't hear about it. She says this: so one might think the uprising would be eagerly greeted by the West. From Britain and Europe, however, there has only been a lukewarm response. No one's really been up happy about this or encouraging the protesters as much as they can. Because, as she points out, there's two reasons. One, they don't really see the need for Iranian regime to fall. That's probably the part of the Western position, let's say the European position. They don't understand how wicked and evil and hell-bent the regime is at bringing destruction to the world. And two, they don't want to acknowledge that President Trump's campaign against Iran is working. And so that's why we didn't hear much of it. What she says at the end of her piece here, she says, this was in the Times, she says, the grave threat it poses has caused the West to turn the other way, meaning that, it's a huge threat, but we can't go and fight it because it'll mean war. But she says, but the choice has never been between peace or war with Iran. It's between defeating the regime or suffering war on its terms. So she sees that true nature of the Iranian regime. Europe probably doesn't, and they don't want to acknowledge the success of Mr. Trump's campaign so far.
So we talked about last week the difference in the way that Iran has handled protests in Iraq versus Lebanon. I would like to get an update of what's happening there, but how much of Iran already under pressure, already on the back foot because of those protests taking place elsewhere, has that intensified Iran's response here? Like the fact that this is a more robust crackdown against protests than we've really seen in the nation's history. It seems like there definitely is a link or an effort by the regime to send a strong message.
Yeah, and that's why they just came out. Right away, they said like day or two of these protests, they said the IRGC said we're going to shut them down. Internet was blacked out, and they went after them and shot people. And that'll stop a protest. Just shoot to kill. And, we saw this next door in Iraq, and this is what Iran was worried about, that if they didn't stop those protests, they're going to bleed over into Iran. Obviously, the population isn't strong enough right now to rise up against the regime. And so Iran put it down forcefully and put it down quickly. We're still seeing these protests take place in Iraq and Lebanon. In Iraq, I think there's another 15 protesters that were killed overnight. And so they are a bit more resilient, these protesters, just because you have a greater anti-Iranian feeling inside Iraq. As we have said, the fact that we see mass casualties in Iraq shows that they're treating the Iraqi protests, that is the Iranians, in the same way that they treated the internal protests in Iran. They can't let them succeed. And so they are going to brutally try and put those protests down, and they'll continue to use these desperate tactics to do that. We did see a change in the protests in Lebanon this week. We actually saw on Sunday and Monday Hezbollah come out and violently suppress the protesters themselves. This is something Hezbollah has not wanted to do because they are in a more tenuous situation over there. Hezbollah, of course, is the Iranian-backed terrorist group and political party that runs a lot of Lebanon. And these protests have turned into an anti-Hezbollah, anti-Iranian protest in many ways in Lebanon. Not as much as the other two, as in Iraq. But nevertheless, it is worrying for Hezbollah and Iran, their power hold. And they have got to walk the tightrope in Lebanon of trying to suppress the protests, because if the protest is successful, they have lost their power, position of power inside the government. But at the same time, they can't go out and shoot people, as it is going to arouse a large percentage of the masses in Lebanon to rise up and fight against them, and even the Lebanese army to actually stand between the protesters and the Hezbollah supporters, as they did on Sunday and Monday. There is a danger of a huge schism going to take place in Lebanon, and that's why Hezbollah has been a little bit more tentative to suppress these. However, it looks like there's no way out for Hezbollah right now. A lot of people are writing this, that they have dug themselves into this corner, and they have got to compromise with their power internally in terms of how they're going to wield power in politics, or they're going to have to try and suppress it violently. And if they do that, it means civil war inside Lebanon.
Very briefly, Brent, where would you send people for more information and just the prophetic context of what you're talking about?
I just wrote an article in the latest print edition. It goes up, it's already up online right now that people can read. It's about whether Iran is losing power or not. We look at these protests in Iraq and in Lebanon, show how that Bible prophecy says that Iran is not, the regime is not going to fall. These protests are not going to be successful in Iran. They're not going to be successful in Iraq, but there is great likelihood that they will be successful at routing Iranian power from Lebanon. And again, that's based on prophecies found in the Bible.
The title of that article is Iran's Power Slipping. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. And thank you very much for that, Brent. Britain is about to hold an election, and the two main parties just published their manifestos. They give us a very interesting picture of the state of British politics today. To learn about this, we'll go to our man in Britain, Daniel DeSanto.
Yes. So Labour just launched their manifesto on Thursday, last Thursday. Conservatives launched theirs on Sunday. And what we're getting is much like what we've seen in America. You're seeing a lot of polarization and a lot of really radical ideas from the left. We'll go into Labour first. So Labour wants to increase spending dramatically, so much so that many, many people who would even usually not be so critical of them have realized that their plan is quite extraordinary. CapEx, one of the websites that comments on financial matters like this, said, quote, Labour's manifesto is nothing if not bold. So it's an extremely bold one. They also called it extraordinary. They asked, is Labour becoming an economics free zone? So does Labour even care about the economy anymore?
Mm-hmm.
They went on to say, Labour's new radicalization brings with it two very dangerous rhetorical positions. First is dismissing detail as of no account, as Corbyn's answers to a point-by-point questioning demonstrated at Labour's manifesto launch. The second is disavowal of the energies and costs of governing. So in other words, Labour is just glossing over all the details of how much it costs to run a government or how much energy would be expended just by the sheer weight of the bureaucracy, let alone all of the spending and the tax increases as well, which they are planning for British society. CapEx just finished off by saying, quote, detail matters. And that's something that Labour seems to be ignoring. So, for example, what are we talking about when we mean radical financial policies? Well, Labour wants to make a gigantic hike in revenue and from tax, from corporation tax. And of course, this is what companies pay when they come to Britain. Right now, London especially is a hub for the financial industry. It's a big place that people will invest in. And really, Britain wants to attract that investment from Europe and from around the world. But Jeremy Corbyn's plan would be to raise that corporate tax from 19%, where it is now, to 26%. So that's almost a 10% increase, dramatic increase. The revenue he would be gaining from that tax raise would be 39%. Now, that's not all. He also plans to nationalize 10% of each company which employs over 250 people. That would be government-mandated nationalization. In other words, making it part of the government, essentially. And he would be forcing that on employees. According to UK law firms, these employee share schemes where employees invest in the company that they're working for, they are common in the UK. But to actually mandate that, to force that from the government on the people, is actually unprecedented. So this would be a real step in a way towards socialism, which is what Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party are already quite well known for. Now, besides that, there's plenty in his manifesto, but we're only going to hit the highlights because there's so much. Tax hikes would go up to 45% on earnings above £80,000 a year. So if you're making £80,000 a year, you're going to be paying 45% of that. And we would see an astonishing 50% on earnings above £125,000 per year.
So Britain is already pretty highly taxed, and this is essentially Jeremy Corbyn and Labour saying it's not high enough in order to pay for all of these things. And he's been pretty outspoken saying that, yes, we are going to have to raise taxes. Although, as you said, when it comes to some of the things that he's proposing, when people question him on it, how are you going to pay for this or that, he's very evasive and acts like, well, the way that you pay for it isn't nearly as important as the fact that you pay for it, that we just have to pay for it somehow. That's what's most important. It seems like this manifesto really just codifies what we've already known about Labour in a lot of ways. Maybe we could move ahead to the conservative side of things. It seems like they've taken a pretty major step kind of in the same direction in some ways.
Right. Well, conservatives, they are advocating a tax reduction in one way, from 19% corporate tax to 17%. However, they are still planning to greatly increase a lot of Britain's welfare programs. So those will be receiving increased spending as well. Now, this could perhaps create a short financial resurgence in a way. This could help, just because taxes will be lower, businesses will have more incentive to invest, people will be getting more money to spend. But of course, this can't last forever. And like we've seen in the United States, debt will pile up and pile up, but of course, it has to end somewhere. Now, the conservatives have also made some conspicuous cuts. It's been really a deafening silence for the defense industry, because they've basically not addressed this issue in their manifesto at all, as to how they're going to pay for the needs of Britain's already shrinking military. Of course, the Labour Party would like to see Britain's military cut to extreme levels. They don't even want to use nuclear weapons at all. The Conservative Party was basically silent on this issue. And after what happened in the Strait of Hormuz back a few months ago, where Iran actually seized a British tanker, which was a gigantic embarrassment for the country, people are realizing Britain needs more ships, but everyone is wondering, where is this going to come from? Because most of the funding is going to the NHS, is going to welfare programs, and not to Britain's already ailing defense industry. There have even been speculations that Britain is ready to either lease or mothball its second aircraft carrier. These are two new aircraft carriers that Britain has just built, and they're even speculating already, either lease it to the US or just put it in storage. So this just points to how little room there is for maneuver when both Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn want to fund social programs to such an extent.
So put this in a prophetic context for us, Daniel.
Well, Mr. Armstrong, he was the founder of the Plain Truth magazine, our predecessor, and he always prophesied that there are two major important things. Well, in this context, he always prophesied that Britain would lose its sea gates and that the United States and Britain would also become besieged economically, that they would have a financial crash. So, of course, we see Britain's military power waning. This is already evident in so many ways. We've seen territory after territory, for example, Hong Kong, as was being mentioned earlier, we've seen that fall to other powers like China. And we just see Britain's military continuing to weaken, which is what Mr. Armstrong would continually go back to. He also talked about that financial crash, and he warned about that from Deuteronomy 28, which talks about losing gates, losing those sea gates, and then being besieged in all your gates, which is referring to Israel or Britain and America. Now, you can also look to Mr. Fleury's new book, Great Again. And this is published just a few years ago, and he talks about the temporary resurgence which we're seeing in America. And also, there have been articles on the Trumpet, especially by Mr. Richard Palmer, about making Britain great again. Is Britain having a resurgence? Why are we seeing a little bit of, especially a financial resurgence? Mm-hmm. So Mr. Richard Palmer, in that article, Making Britain Great Again, writes, Mr. Johnson has brought a new sense of purpose and optimism to the government. Minutes after he was announced as the leader of Britain's Conservative Party on July 23rd, he said, we are once again going to believe in ourselves and in what we can achieve. And like some slumbering giant, we are going to rise and ping off the guy ropes of self-doubt and negativity. So these are words that we haven't heard in a long time in Britain. We haven't heard such optimistic talk in a long time. And then he went on to say, though, God prophesied that there would be a resurgence in end-time Israel. There has been. He warned that it would be temporary. It will be. So if you'd like to find out more about that, I would direct you straight to Mr. Gerald Fleury's book, Great Again, and you'll see how there's going to be a slight resurgence in these nations, America and Britain, and also how that resurgence, as we might be seeing already with this election, is quite temporary.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Daniel. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a short break, but first, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief often encourages us to study history. Just one example, he gave a television program not long ago, a Key of David episode called The Ultimate Understanding of History, where he said, history is the most important subject you can study, not just secular history, but Bible history. He said that the history of what God is doing is the ultimate understanding of history, and if we don't have that, we're going to have serious troubles. We have another program on Trumpet Radio that delves into secular and Bible history. It's called Rewind Repeat. It's presented by David Vigil, a man we featured on Trumpet Hour a number of times. And this program aims to make your Bible come to life through the study of history. He does this in short mini-series, a number of episodes on a single topic. And his first series is complete, and it's there online. It's about the history of Charlemagne. It covers the origins of the Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire. So if you want to see how the Bible prophesied the rise of both these world-dominating institutions and Charlemagne's reign, and then track it in history, give this program a listen. Rewind, Repeat. You can find it under the Listen tab at thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Iran has made several provocations in recent months, which European nations, among many other nations, are concerned about. But France has been stepping up its efforts to confront Iran. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
There was an important security conference last weekend in which the French defense minister, Florence Parly, she basically went after the United States for its position in the region, going back to the Obama in the Middle East, going back to the Obama administration, also the Trump administration, showing that the world order, or at least the regional order that has been had the United States as the cornerstone of that, that's upheld the security of the Middle East, is now eroded. And she proves this by talking about the Obama's lack of action in Syria when the chemical weapons were used. She called it deliberate, gradual U.S. disengagement. And then she started to talk about the recent actions where Iran used the mine ships in the Persian Gulf, and that was unanswered. Then the drone got shut down, and that was unanswered, she said. And then the major oil facilities were bombed, and this was unanswered. And she says this, quote, "The signs in the region hint at the severe weakening of an order based on cooperation, that mix of U.S. presence, norms, a degree of multilateralism, some stability of governance, and a great deal of deterrence." Then she said this, "The edifice has started shaking, and opportunists rush in." And so she was basically saying that since the United States is refusing to act militarily, that the deterrence against Iranian action is gone. And she said now that some other nations are going to have to act. Seth Fransman from the Jerusalem Post said this, "This was no ordinary speech, but a shot across the bow of U.S. policy and a signal that to the region that France is concerned and wants to play a deeper role." And so this lady came out and said, doesn't matter if Trump gets in next election, doesn't matter if the Democrats are going to get in. American policy has been over the past decade, retreat from the Middle East. This is going to continue. And I think she's completely right in that assessment. And now she wants France to have a role to restore some order. And so she's doing that. France is starting up a naval mission starting January to police boats coming through the Persian Gulf or out of the Persian Gulf. 10 nations, most of them from Europe, have signed up to go with this French-led mission. And so Bible prophecy indicates that France and European nations are going to be more heavily involved in the Middle East. They are going to try and counter the Iranian threat. And this happens because America is no longer in the region. And so France's position here, though it's all talk at this moment, they are going to start their active military campaign at the start of January inside the Persian Gulf.
So we focus a lot, Gerald Fleury has talked a lot about Germany confronting Iran. The fact is that the prophecy that he's basing that on is really talking about the fact that it's a German-led European power, that you would have France taking steps along these lines really does tie in with that. It's not necessarily contrary to what Germany has done. It could be very well complementary.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what we've seen a lot of Germany of late is hiding behind the trigger-happy French, it seems. And so they're happy to do that. And I wouldn't be surprised if one of these nations joining the coalition, they've been tight-lipped about it, which who they are is going to be Germany. Netherlands said over the weekend, or last weekend, that they are going to join this. So we definitely, as a European force, European ships that are going to be in the Persian Gulf, protecting as they see it, from Iranian aggression. And that's what that prophecy in Daniel 11 and 40 says. It says, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall push at him, and the king of the north, that is this German-led Europe, is going to come against him like a whirlwind. And it specifically says many ships. And so it helps if European ships are in the region.
Well, we do have an article about this on thetrumpet.com by Warren Reinsch. The title of that, France Postures to Confront Iran. Go check that out. And thank you very much, Brent. Europe is expanding militarily. In one area that it's increasing its budget in significantly is in space. For this, we'll go back to Daniel DeSanto.
All right. So yesterday, Thursday, the European Space Agency's 22 members agreed to a massive increase in spending. This is, as they said on their website, the most ambitious plan to date for the future of the European Space Agency as a whole and the whole European space sector. Now, what did they agree to? Basically, $15.8 billion. Compare that to NASA. NASA is at $21.5 billion, plus another $14 billion on the military space program itself. So that seems like a pretty big difference. But what will Europe be able to achieve? Well, let's compare this to China as well. China spends $8.4 billion, and Russia as well. Russia spends $3 billion. So if you look at these numbers, you can actually see when you factor in what Russia and China are able to do on that smaller sum of money, and then the colossal waste that we know has been going on at NASA for quite some time, we can actually see that this makes Europe now a formidable contender in the space industry. Now, this will be an increase of 4 billion euros over the previous budget. And it's been described by other officials, the head of the French Space Agency, for example, as a giant step forward for Europe 50 years after the moon landing. And that mention of the moon landing is significant because some of these projects that we're seeing here are about actually sending Europeans to the moon. They're looking at building a project called Gateway, which is the first space station ever that will orbit the moon. They want to send Europeans to the moon's surface. They want to develop fully flexible satellite systems to integrate the 5G cellular and data network. And they want to also build a reusable spaceship. So essentially, this is Europe catching up to the United States and Russia. And they've made a gigantic step forward with this massive budget. Everyone was actually surprised by how much was spent. Even some of the space agency officials themselves were taken back by just how much. Some countries even gave more than they were asked to. So this is quite a step forward for them. Now, as we look at European space technology, we always have to keep in mind that this is everything in space can be a dual-use technology. And that means it can be used for both commercial and military purposes. So take Copernicus, the satellites which we use to monitor environmental disasters, floods. Those are observation satellites, and those can easily be, of course, used besides for looking at the environment. They can also be used to spy on foreign powers, to manage a war zone, to see what's going on down on the Earth. There's another problem that Europe is facing, which is space junk. And for this, they're making robots or space robots which can retrieve old satellites, bring them back down to Earth. Well, these could also be used, of course, to damage or disable an enemy satellite. It works both ways. Once you have that technology for commercial or for scientific purposes, you can also use it for military purposes. So we've been watching this for some time. We've written already about Germany. It already has a space force. Mr. Josue Michels, a native German, wrote Germany's Unnoticed Space Program. You can check out that article. In terms of what we're watching, there's a scripture in Ezekiel 7:14 says, "They have blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle." So Mr. Fleury wrote that this is describing America and Britain in the next war, and they're being besieged and there's a cyber attack. Now, he's talking about their reliance on computers, on technology, and this reliance on satellites is closely tied to all of that.
Well, we will definitely put links in the show notes to these articles that you just mentioned. Josue's article, Germany's Unnoticed Space Program, and then Gerald Fleury's article about America's Achilles heel and Germany. It is remarkable just how aggressive Europeans are getting in increasing their capability there in space. We do appreciate you bringing that to us, Daniel. Moving on to Asia, as Americans were observing Thanksgiving Day yesterday, North Korea celebrated by test firing some unidentified projectiles. For this story, we'll go back to Rufaro Manyepa.
Yes, sir. Yesterday, North Korea fired two unidentified projectiles into its eastern coastal waters, and it later came out and said that these were its tests for its super large multiple launch rocket system. And according to North Korea, this is so that they can pressure the U.S. into relieving economic sanctions that are being leveled against them. And it's really interesting how the United States is pressuring North Korea with these sanctions in order to stop them from carrying out such tests. But North Korea is continuing to carry out these tests in order to get the sanctions relieved. And I think that's the main problem with what the United States is doing, because it's coupling the economic pressure with a system of appeasement in which it's suspended its joint military exercises with South Korea just last week in the hopes of appeasing North Korea and getting them to come to the table once again and talk in regards to halting all these things that they're doing. So this simultaneous action of sanctions and appeasement doesn't seem to be yielding results for the United States, and are actually only emboldening Pyongyang. This was the 14th missile test that North Korea has done this year, and Kim Jong-un has actually said that if the United States does not relieve sanctions by the end of the year, they're only going to ratchet up the number that they do in 2020. And he's basically given President Trump an ultimatum of what they are supposed to do. And even North Korean officials came out and said that, well, we're really frustrated by these sanctions because they're showing that the United States is so preoccupied with impeachment proceedings and all these political issues happening in their own country. They're not paying attention to North Korea at all, and therefore North Korea is upset by that. And the problem with that is it leaves room for China to come in. Last month, after the United States and North Korea canceled their talks broke down, China came in and said that it's committed to strengthening these ties with North Korea, these ties that have stood the test of time. And that's really worrying from an American perspective, because you see how with the continual failing that they're having at bringing North Korea to the table, China's just there waiting in the wings. It's ready to just swoop in and replace America as far as its military and economic cooperation with North Korea. And that is, according to Bible prophecy, the kings of the East are prophesied to come together in one massive power block that leaves out the United States. And we can see that in how the U.S. is failing more and more to regulate North Korea, and China is there waiting to be the power that really does cooperate with North Korea.
Where would you send people for more information, Rufaro?
We have an excellent booklet, Russia and China and Prophecy. It really brings out the idea of this united Asian power bloc and how they're all going to come together under China and Russia.
All right. Thank you for that, Rufaro. Our last story in the program today, drug cartels are taking over vast sections of Mexico. U.S. President Donald Trump wants to get more aggressive in confronting them. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this week on Tuesday, President Trump announced that he's trying to designate Mexican drug cartels as terrorist organizations. He made these comments in an interview with the former Fox News host Bill O'Reilly, saying that I will be designating the cartels. I have been working on this for at least 90 days. You know, designation is not that easy. You have to go through a process, but we are well into that process. And so this would be a big game changer in the war against drugs in the United States. Right now, because drug cartels, they're not carrying that terrorist status. The fight against them is mostly waged by state and local police, similar to how you'd deal with any other street gang. But as soon as you get the legal designation in place as a terrorist organization, that opens the door for the federal government to get much more involved. I think the current president of Mexico has already spoken out against the U.S. trying to do this because he's afraid of like drone strikes or other U.S. military intervention in his country that would become options on the table once you're fighting a war against a terrorist organization instead of treating it like local crime. So we'll definitely keep our eye on that in the future to see how this unfolds. It could definitely hurt bilateral trade relationships with Mexico, which is prophesied with the Isaiah 23 Mart of Nations, powers like Mexico teaming up with Europe to besiege the United States. It could also lead to increased violence, like is prophesied in Ezekiel 5, as one of the curses for a nation that turns against from God is just like violence and rioting that could result from declaring war on an organization like a drug cartel like this. It's definitely they're a violent organization that needs to be dealt with, but as Mexico's found in the past, that when you start fighting them, they have a tendency to start fighting back, which could increase those violence unless, as is brought out in so much of Mr. Gerald Flores' literature, America gets to the root cause of the problem and starts trying to solve its problem with drug cartels by repentance, having stronger families, fewer people addicted to drugs, instead of trying to treat the symptom instead of the cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where have we written about that? If someone wanted to read more about that.
Actually, our book, No Freedom Without Law, is probably the best resource for going back down into just like the root cause is of drug addiction and the ill effects that has on society.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Rufaro Manyepa, Daniel DeSanto, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with the words of Edgar Watson Howe. If you don't learn to laugh at trouble, you won't have anything to laugh at when you're old. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.